This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick intro section with some news. Then we're going to be joined by K-Tom to go through the transition from the CCG to the LCG. And then because that went a little long, we're going to have a very quick final remarks.
All right, John, this is episode 36. Have we caught up to your age yet?
We have.
Oh, there we go.
Yep. Very exciting.
Very exciting indeed. Time to call it quits. We're getting too old for this shit.
I guess that's it. No more podcasts. We're done.
News from the week. News from the week. There are a pair of really big tournaments, actually.
Yeah, the Spanish Nationals happened. And I think prize is actually a flight to Worlds. So that's a pretty big tournament.
It was. Not only that, so this is something, I love it when it happens. The final in that match was Tarkin, who was the European champion last year, versus Aoria, Alvaro Rodriguez, who was the world champion last year. This is big, excellent players consistently rising to the top of the field. In the end, Tarkin's Martel No Agenda beat Aoria's Lanny No Agenda. So he takes first place, but since he couldn't take the travel prize, Aoria's coming to Worlds.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Why couldn't he take the travel prize?
I think he just couldn't take the time off, or he had other plans for that thing, so it went to the second place, and Aoria is coming to Worlds again.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. It'll be great, hopefully, to see him.
Yeah.
I'm crossing my fingers to get to Worlds.
Still crossing your fingers. There was a smaller tournament, Motor City Besieged, that I don't have results from yet. I also want to apologize because we didn't mention them on the cast last week. Somehow I've had them scheduled for the week after this, so my apologies, but hopefully that tournament went well. The third major tournament is the Chinese League again. So last time we talked about them, and they wound up complaining that their league was dominated by Greyjoy LIV decks using Crossing the Mummer's Ford. This time, Martel No Agenda won this. But again, they did things differently, and they seem to like to do this, have their own sort of FAQ for their league tournament. So I heard that they had
Wheels Within Wheels Restricted, and one per phase on Harrenhal.
That's right, yeah. Which I don't really agree with that as house rules. I don't know. I guess.
It's up to them, right? They can run their league how they see fits, unofficial. It's an octagon league, so.
I suppose. What else? So there hasn't been a lot of official FFG news. In fact, none this week. I was almost expecting the sixth chapter pack announcement, given how quickly they show up now. But we had initially thought that we were going to do a pre-FAQ episode. And last time we did a pre-FAQ episode, the FAQ came out the exact same day we released the pre-FAQ episode.
So we decided not to this time.
And mostly I think the FAQ, it may well come as early as Monday, the day you're listening to this cast. But I don't think there's a lot of pre-FAQ discussion needed. We've talked about the cards in general that we expect to see hit. So if we do get an FAQ, though, we'll try and rush an episode out early sometime in the week. And finally, we don't want to drag this on too long because this episode runs way long. I just want to take time to thank people again for all the comments that we've gotten on our podcast. The last three episodes have all had something in the vicinity of 20 posts, people commenting, giving us questions, giving us suggestions for future casts and rule segments.
We really appreciate that because it actually gives us the reason to keep doing the cast, because we do it for the community. And, you know, if no one was listening, there wouldn't be much point.
Yeah. So, I've noticed the same thing for 2C1Cs. There's a lot more comments going up on their episodes. And I think that's great. It makes us feel like that the community is more engaged in the podcast, and that's very, very important.
So how are you doing in the Octagon Tournament, Alex?
Oh, I thought you wouldn't ask this week because of your humiliating defeat.
No, I mean, I'm okay with my loss. Played a good player. I won't talk about his deck too much. He played Maesters, so I've gotten two losses to Maesters in the tournament, but because of the error on my part filling in the form or something, I'm now out of the Octagon tournament.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the deck you ran to this point?
Yeah, sure. I was running a Barra Nightwatch deck using the Steward's Agenda, which allowed me to use a Blizzard of Castle to give my Barra characters the Intrigue icon, which was extremely effective. It basically let me have Bright Waterman of Arms as tricons that don't kneel on attack and defense. It wasn't a Tier 1 deck. It was a fun deck that I did have a good time playing, and that's, you know, what I went into the tournament for. So.
All right. Well, I'm still in the running. I played one of the world's best Stark players, Derek Schumacher, Sir Duck. He was playing a Darkwing's Dark Words, which I told him he had to call Starkwing Duck. He says his deck's so shitty he doesn't deserve a name. His word's not mine. He's not very happy. He locked himself into his restricted choice, and he would have liked to swap that out. So yeah. I wound up with a fairly convincing early lead, and there really wasn't much of an opportunity for turnaround. So I'm 5-1.
Excellent. And you're playing a competitive deck or also a fun deck, Alex?
I'm playing a Greyjoy LIV. I think I've mentioned it before. I basically took our Canadian Nationals version. I ripped out the winter module and replaced it with stuff. And about half of what I replaced it with was a good idea. The other half wasn't, but I haven't tweaked it since. For instance, I have some Warcrest events, and I think I have like 3 Warcrests in the deck. So it's not finely tweaked, but the core of the deck is still pretty...
I guess with no further ado, we're going to get into a guest that everyone has been just chomping at the bit to hear.
We're joined this week by a guest that needs no introduction, and like most guests that need no introduction, we're going to introduce them anyways, especially since we've been recently reminded that we should be more friendly to new players that don't know everything about the community. So, K-Tom, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, gee, that's kind of a loaded question. I don't really know how I'm supposed to introduce myself.
Let me do it for you, then. He's the Dragon of Aegon, the rules lawyer supreme, the judge with the most. It's K-Tom.
Okay, do I have to sign off on that or something?
Yeah, that sounds like an ending, not a beginning.
Really? It's kind of one of those things that this moniker of rules lawyer and high authority is something that I accept very grudgingly, because I would really prefer that people would think it through for themselves. I hear it all the time that people say, oh, well, K-Tom says. I think that's a really awful way to do a ruling, is K-Tom says. If you can't explain what I have explained, then I don't think that that's a ruling you ought to be following. You ought to be able to understand it enough to repeat it yourself.
Unless you're TOing the event, and then too bad,
well,
is what you said.
That's completely different. I mean, the TO is always right. Even when they're wrong, they're right.
It's worth noting that although this, what K-Tom says, it shouldn't be the definitive ruling, there are a lot of cases, and we won't get into that today, where the only authority that we have for rulings that date back to almost CCG-era rulings tends to be, well, you.
Well, that's actually kind of an interesting way of putting it, because not only do I have this kind of rules lawyer thing these days, but I also have kind of the historian aspect of it, just because I have so few other interests that I just keep sticking around the community. And so I remember things that go all the way back to the first CCG block, which was, what, 2003, 2004, somewhere in that area?
So how did you start playing Thrones?
Probably I started playing the way that most people did. I read the books, I liked the books, found out that there was a CCG, had played CCGs before, but was having trouble finding not so much a game, but a community that really fit, or that was really something that I enjoyed being a part of, and, you know, gave Thrones a try just from the fact that I enjoyed the material so much, and it stuck because the Thrones community is a really great group of guys. And girls. It's a much lower percentage there, but definitely a lot of the women that play are some of the smartest and most interesting women you're going to run into, at least in gaming circles.
So back in the CCGs, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know a lot about the CCG, because I started playing only in the LCG. They had like something they called blocks, right, which was like a section of cards, kind of like Magic does. So which one did you join the game in? Because were you there with when it, you know, the first introduction, the first block, or were you somewhere else?
Well, the blocks were always a base set that came out late in summer. There was always the new Gen Con thing was a new base set. And then about every 3 months or so, 3 to 4 months, they would put out an expansion. So a block was a base set and two expansions. I started playing in the first expansion of the first block. So I missed the initial release of the base set, but it was still readily available when I jumped in on the first expansion, which was the Sea of Storms expansion that introduced Greyjoy for the first time. So one of the reasons I've always been a strong or always kind of gravitated toward Greyjoy.
So I've taken the opportunity here to ask Google to fill in my knowledge gaps because it seems to be smarter than me. And I can see that before it went into LCG, it seems like there was six blocks, but there's something strange about the final
really.
Block.
There were kind of five and a half blocks. There were six base sets. But the announcement for the LCG, the decision by FFG to transition from the CCG to the LCG, came out right on the heels of that sixth block. That sixth block was the Five Kings edition. It was a phenomenal set of cards, by the way. So that Five Kings edition, the announcement of, hey, we're going to switch over to this LCG model and here's what that means, came out at about that time. And one of the first things they said is, as a result of this, there will be no expansions to the Five Kings edition. And we're actually going to turn the first two, or what we have planned for the first two expansions, into the first two sets of chapter packs. So the, it's a Clash of Canaan, sorry, it's a Clash of Arms, isn't it? Clash of Arms is the first chapter pack set?
Yeah.
Too many names, I can never keep them all straight. But the,
Clash of Canaan, War of the Five Kings was the first pack.
Right, and so, but yeah, the whole Clash of Arms set of six chapter packs was supposed to be the first expansion set for the Five Kings edition. It's one of the reasons why that there's so many cards that reference things like the kingdom locations and the traded plots, the military battle, power struggle, and intrigue gambit, because those were the big new mechanics that were introduced in the Five Kings block. So that's why that set kind of falls outside a lot of the other LCGs and was really difficult to use until they had the Greyjoy expansion block that puts some of those elements, those kingdom locations and those traded plots, back into the environment.
So before we delve too deeply into the switch over to the LCG, I'm sort of wondering how different the CCG was. I mean, I've heard that, for instance, Streets were chase rares, where they were the rare cards in packs, and they would always make your deck better, so you were trying to find, make sure you got at least one Streak. But were there any fundamental rules differences, or was it just a difference in distribution?
Well, the biggest difference really was the distribution, that they're, because of the rarities of the cards, you would have things that became real power cards. And like any CCG, the people that could put together the big collection of rare cards tended to do really well, because the rarer the card, the stronger it tended to be. In terms of the rules, the basic rules are exactly the same, with the exception of the taxation phase. The whole taxation phase was added to the LCG. So in the CCG, when you counted gold, you did that at the beginning of Marshalling, same as now, but any gold that you didn't spend in Marshalling went away. So there were no gold tokens. It was one of the hardest things for people transitioning from CCG to LCG to learn, was to grab gold tokens. So anyway, you got rid of all of the gold at the end of the marshalling phase, and there was no gold pool. Gold did not work as a separate resource. It was one of the reasons that influence was added to the game in the first place, was so that there was a resource pool that could be used through phases other than marshalling.
See, I remember, and I'm not sure where I heard this, but someone mentioning that this was actually Martin's involvement initially in the CCG, saying that he didn't want gold to pay for events. Again, this is all very nebulous to me, but that there was actually some initial involvement there from Martin himself, and that was, I guess, reversed as the transition to the LCG?
Well, that's entirely possible. I know that Martin had a really big input and influence on a lot of the early mechanics of the game in the first couple of blocks. And I know from talking to Eric Lang that the idea of influence was always kind of in the back of his mind as something that would need to be added just so that there was a resource curve, something to go. So, I mean, I've never heard that Martin was the one that said, no, gold can't be a resource through the entire thing and to pay for events. I'd never heard that before, but it makes as much sense as anything else.
All right, well, you heard it here first, possibly, or not. If someone remembers where I might have heard this, please let me know.
Hey, if nothing else, it's one of those really cool rumors that should be true.
I like it.
Yeah, but in terms of the transition and adding it into the LCG, I know that one of the things they wanted to do was make the whole game as appealing to Game of Thrones fans as humanly possible. They really wanted to kind of trade on the license. So they had six phases to that point, and they wanted the symmetry of seven phases, seven kingdoms. And so that's one of the reasons where taxation came from and why taxation is almost this throwaway phase, exists as a separate phase.
Seven phases, seven kingdoms, six houses.
Well, nine houses if you really want to get into it. But
yeah. Now, I remember hearing that the CCG was actually doing quite well, that it was generally regarded as being quite a success, unlike another CCG they had at the time, which was Call of Cthulhu, which wasn't doing so well, and they were fiddling around with the distribution model for Cthulhu. I don't know. I sort of have heard that Cthulhu wound up being a test model for the LCG, but I'm a little fuzzy on the details.
Well, that is true. So Game of Thrones was the first CCG. Whether or not you would call it a successful CCG kind of depends on which side of the fence you were sitting on. When you compare it to things like Legend of the Five Rings or obviously Magic or, you know, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh!, all of those things that really are the huge CCGs, it was nowhere near that kind of size. But at the time, there was like a CCG on every street corner, and Game of Thrones was doing a lot better than most of those other ones. Based on the success of the CCG for Game of Thrones, which was FFG's first foray into the CCG market, they created Call of Cthulhu. It's another Eric Lang game. It's actually a really good game. It's a lot of fun if you've ever played it, but it never really found the same kind of audience that Game of Thrones did, and it tended to follow a model very similar to other CCGs at the time that kind of lasted for two to four years. Year three seemed to always be the big one for CCGs, and I think that has something to do with that year three is about the time where you need to come up with a rotation strategy. But that's really, so Call of Cthulhu never quite found the same footing as Game of Thrones, even though it was a great game. So it ended up having a really dedicated core following, but Gen Con World Tournaments would be 12 people, and from year to year, it would be the same 12 people. So it wasn't really successful, and rather than just throw the game out entirely, FFG went into kind of that different model. They said, okay, well, we can't produce cards because we don't sell enough of them in that CCG collectible model, so we're going to go to this model of what they called asylum packs, and three or four times a year we're going to put out a block of like 30 or 60 cards. And that way the people that are really diehard Call of Cthulhu players are still getting new cards. The game isn't gone entirely, but we're not putting the kind of money and effort into supporting a CCG that the market isn't there for. And a lot of people looked at it as something of a swan song for Call of Cthulhu. They didn't think that it would last very long in this fixed model. But it turned out to be a really successful and well-received model. People liked the fixed packs. They weren't chasing rares. Everyone was really kind of on an equal footing, and it turned the whole community and it turned the whole play experience into being about playing the game rather than chasing the cards. So in effect, Call of Cthulhu became the first LCG, and it worked so well that FFG looked at it and said, you know, we need to do this for Game of Thrones, because even though Game of Thrones is stronger than Call of Cthulhu, it gains as much as it loses, so it doesn't really grow. It's not really getting any bigger. We've taken it about as far as we can as a CCG, because truth be told, FFG is not a CCG company. They're not really set up to support the kind of growth and the kind of throughput that you'd really see in a CCG in terms of an ever-revolving player base, and it was never really going to grow to that size under FFG, which is really more about tabletop and board games.
Right, because you need like a huge organized play base. You need a huge marketing component to be able to push the game out and some way to engage the stores to run your games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that you'll notice is that a lot of these CCGs have professional bases to them. People play this for money, and you can't really fault FFG for saying, you know what, we never want to make our organized play program about someone winning money. They never wanted to do cash prizes. And a lot of the competitive play programs for these CCGs really kind of revolve around kind of that professional tour.
One of the reasons that we're specifically discussing the CCG right now is because the transition from a CCG to an LCG may have nothing to do with the transition that we're expecting come November, but everyone sort of feels like the game is going to have some long-term change in vision come November. So was that teased? Did people see the Asylum packs as a way? Did they think that was coming to Thrones? Were they expecting it? How did FFG ease players into that process?
Well, that was kind of the problem. Well, but no, it was the problem at the time. But I think FFG really learned from it. And when you're talking about rotation, you know, you have to remember that the better model for what's likely to happen in November is adding rotation into Thrones for the first time, which is more like what happened back in the Valyrian. I think it was the Valyrian block, the third block of the CCG. So that's probably the better model for what's likely to happen in November than the transition from CCG to LCG, because CCG to LCG changed absolutely everything. And personally, I don't think that it is likely that a rotation scheme is going to change everything in the same way. But to answer your question more specifically, no one really saw Asylum packs coming to Game of Thrones. No one really expected what was happening to Call of Cthulhu to happen to Game of Thrones, because Thrones was, comparatively speaking, a very strong program. It was a very strong game. It was a solid CCG, whereas Call of Cthulhu had trouble finding and expanding an audience.
So I guess if nobody sort of saw it coming, how do you announce some big change like that in a game that is currently successful?
Well, and that was kind of the thing, is that the announcement kind of came out of nowhere, but it was put forth in such a way that when everyone first heard the announcement, I think that most people were really willing to give it the benefit of the doubt and said, you know what, they make a lot of really good points, and I'm interested to see how it's going to work. So, you know, take yourself back to just roughly 2007, and the base set has just come out, and it's a really fun base set. You're really enjoying it. And in fact, the Gen Con tournament where it had been introduced was one of the biggest joust tournaments that we had seen in years. It was a really great turnout. So everyone was really excited. The game really kind of felt like it was at a high point. And then FFG comes out, and it came straight from the CEO. And I think that that was actually a good decision, to have the repositioning and reformulation of the CCG into the LCG and explaining it coming right from Christian, coming right from the CEO, rather than filtering through. And the way that he explained it was that, you know, we've kind of taken this as far as we can as a CCG, and I'm largely paraphrasing this. I think that I think you can still find the letter online somewhere.
Yeah,
but,
actually, I have to thank John Crouse for that. We asked around a little bit, and he was able to dig up this letter, and we'll link it with the article as well. I'm not a huge fan of the tone of the letter, but The content was a lot of points.
Well, and that's kind of the give and take on this one. So the points that were made that FFG is a board game company and we're really not put together in such a way that we can support the long-term collectability model of this. It's not what we do best. And our channels aren't really built to help us grow this kind of thing. So we want to transition this into something that looks a little bit more familiar to a board gamer, which was a big impetus behind the equalization of melee play. So multiplayer was always something that was part of Thrones. It was never really part of competitive Thrones, except as like side events up until that point. But it was something that people enjoyed as that side event kind of thing. So they said, but since we're going to this more board game model, we're going to push melee a little bit harder. We're going to turn it into a real competitive format right alongside the Joust, right alongside the one-on-one format. So, you know, all of this sounded really good, and getting through that whole idea of, you know what, they're absolutely right. They're a board game company. Switching this over to a fixed more board game, not only am I going to have to spend less to chase down a play set of some of the cards I really want to play, but we're going to see there's going to be a bigger influx of players and of support, more people will be familiar with the game. It sounded like a really positive thing. And so, you know, everyone kind of looked at it with, okay, well, it's different, it's a change, but I think that I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt and I'm willing to give it a try. People were a little bit nervous because it essentially said you're not getting new cards in the December time frame, which was when the first expansion usually came out. And they said instead you're going to get it in a February, you're going to get the first set of new cards in a February March time frame, and that'll be the first things that you see in our new fixed format. In fact, I remember that the first people to see the first chapter pack, the War of the Five Kings chapter pack, were the folks at a homegrown tournament, ShyCon, back in 2008. It was hot off the presses. People came down from FFG to the tournament. It was a very casual, a lot of fun, and they brought copies of the chapter pack, and we were able to play our draft tournament at ShyCon. Everyone got a package of the War of the Five Kings to use it as kind of a draft pack within the draft tournament. So, you know, that was the first time that anyone ever saw any of these. So it was, you know, it was really positive, the initial reaction to all of this, and it stayed kind of positive until the changes to organized play and the changes to rotation were announced.
Yeah, that's quite a few things because, first of all, organized play used to have this really robust, this Gold Dragons thing and then this Night's Watch thing, all of which predate me entirely, so I only know them by name.
Well, and the organized play for the CCG was kind of a smaller basis but more frequent thing. Because you can do promos in a CCG that you can't really do in an LCG because everyone is supposed to have equal access to the cards. It's one of the reasons why alternate art is not really the same as a promo because they're the same cards, but they look different. Whereas promo cards can be absolutely unique, different cards. And so the way that the organized play worked for most of the CCG is that individual TOs at a local game store who were called the Night's Watch almost monthly were able to have a supported tournament from FFG, and they would send a fistful of promo cards to hand out to people at the game stores for these monthly tournaments. And so there was no game night, there was no game night kit or league or anything like that. It was just monthly tournaments if you had someone at a game store that was willing to run them. So organized play tended to be a very frequent kind of thing. There were local tournaments at least every month, usually more.
So the Night Watch got rewards for being TOs, for doing this work for FFG, right?
There was right. Kind of, so yeah. Well, and that was so the in addition to the promo cards, you got what were called the Gold Dragons, which was your basic collect and redeem kind of program. And so first, second, and third place winners at the store tournaments would get Gold Dragons, and the Night's Watch would get a Gold Dragon certificate that was equal to first place for running the event. A lot of the TOs after a certain point had so many Gold Dragons that they'd actually throw their Night's Watch certificates into the prize pool. But the redemption could get you additional promo cards that, promo cards tended to be rare and hard to find. And if you wanted extras, you could get them with the Gold Dragons. But then a lot of the first Stonehouse cards and glass bead power counters were produced by FFG, and you could get them through the Gold Dragon Redemption. The other thing to remember is that each booster pack was worth one Gold Dragon. So it wasn't just for the tournament players. Everyone could do the redemption, but obviously it took a lot longer buying card packages than when you win tournaments.
Now, I sort of want to, again, take a little break and mention that we're looking at this letter, we're looking at this transition, and you mentioned that they were going to focus on Melee, but they also describe a game that doesn't look a lot like the one we see now. They describe one where packs will go out of print, that they're limited run packs for the chapter packs, and that eventually that, you won't be able to access them in the long run. And the one most frequent thing that gets cited is that my cards will never rotate out and they will always be useful. And that's nowhere in the initial description of an LCG.
Well, I think that the they will never rotate out was something that isn't in the letter, but it did come out of a whole bunch of people from FFGs did say we're never going to rotate. Instead, the way that we're going to manage it is that we are going to have limited print runs, and once they're sold out, they're sold out. We're never going to reprint them, and that's the way that rotation is going to happen, is that as players come out and players go in, they're going to be – essentially, the card pool is going to change just from the availability of what's in print. Now, they never actually did that. They kept reprinting because people – in the community kept asking them, hey, we can't get these cards. Someone needs to reprint these because we can't get them. And so they kind of changed that feeling on the fly that, okay, well, we will reprint the cards, which means that from the original vision that was described of all cards would always be legal, but they wouldn't always be available in the marketplace because they'll be sold out. It went to all cards will always be legal and all cards will always be available in the marketplace. And when you're doing that, you really run into all the problems that everyone's saying and feeling right now. I see where that becomes a really big barrier to entering the game at this point. Personally, from a playability standpoint, I don't think that you need every card that has ever been printed. I think that if people really sat down and looked at their decks, they'd realize that they are not playing with whole chunks of the card pool. And so why would you tell a new player that they need to buy these chunks that you never use? However, that doesn't change the fact that LCGs still have that kind of hybrid collectability mentality to it that's different from a board game, and a lot of the players that come over to play it really feel like they need to own everything.
I think that's part of it. I think that even if you didn't feel that way, a lot of players that believe, or at least I did when I came into the model, that one of the main advantages was that everyone was on a level playing field. So having a deck that is 98% as efficient as my opponent's, but I don't have Fury of the Wolf, which is a really strong card, feels like I'm missing that little extra nudge, and my opponent, because he got into the game earlier, has that little advantage. And I can see why that doesn't sit well with players.
Because it almost makes some cards a CCG at that point, right, where there's going to be those cards, those little nudges will gain in value for the players that have them. Right, you'll be able to sell them.
Well, and we can sit here and we can debate and argue that point forever, but I would say that there are at least 20 different threads on the various boards that we can refer to people for that. And, it becomes kind of a circular argument, I think, as well. But, for the most part, I get that.
Now, you mentioned that there were some troubles with the release of the LCG and but you said up to the first chapter back, people were willing, people that were still engaging the community. So what were some of the difficulties? Because a lot of players did quit.
A huge chunk of the players quit, and it really came down to problems with how they handled the organized play program. You know, what I talked about before with the monthly tournaments, you know, this really built community. And at the time, people were traveling all over the place. You know, right now, I know that some people travel for different regionals, but they don't really travel that far. In the CCG days, people would go from Iowa to California and vice versa for their regionals just because they enjoyed the people, they enjoyed the game. They were willing to put that kind of time and effort and expense into being part of that community. And, you know, part of the whole switch to, well, we're looking at more of a board game mentality on this. People predicted it from the beginning that there would be less traveling because it would really be more intense, kind of a more intense local flavor. And I think that we're seeing that even now with the regional program and with the store championships, because people do travel a little bit from place to place, but it's there aren't nearly as many people saying, I'm going to hit as many regionals as I possibly can, and I'm charting it out to figure out if I can get to all of the regionals. We've had people in the CCG days that went to every regional.
Certainly not the case anymore. Yeah.
Impossible now because they're a bunch of them are at the same time in two different places, right?
Well, and that's part of it as well, is that you know, we would have like 10 or 12 regionals total rather than, you know, this year they had to actually limited it to around 20. Mm-hmm. And then the year before that, it was really pretty much, there were almost 50 of them, I think.
Yeah, the inclusion of store championships certainly helped them.
Right, I think so. So the whole idea, organized play was really kind of a very central thing. This is very, you know, it was really for the more competitive player, and a lot of really strong ties across the community, across the country, were really kind of developed out of that feeling of camaraderie and that feeling of we really want to get together to play this game. What happened with the LCG is they essentially said that, okay, we're not going to do the monthly tournaments anymore. We're not going to do a redemption program and promos because you can't really do that with an LCG model. We don't know what the organized play program is going to look like yet, but we're not going to be doing what we have been doing anymore. And that was kind of problem number one, is that they ended the old organized play program before knowing what the new one was going to look like, and it was almost a year between the ending of the old organized play program and the institution of a new one. So when your organized play program is what was really kind of holding and growing that community together, without it, a lot of people were just very disenfranchised with the whole thing.
I'm almost surprised that you mentioned that one first. I would have assumed that the very first barrier was that you had a whole bunch of players who were playing Greyjoy and Martell as their house of choice. We know that, for instance, in Europe, people have a lot of house loyalty, and those were completely lost from the card pool.
The reason that I mentioned the change in the card pool second is because that was the one that really blindsided people. People knew that the organized play program was going to need to change. They didn't know what it was going to look like yet, but they trusted FFG to do it. So the fact that they ended one without having a new one ready to go was, you know, was really kind of the first straw in everything. But the one that really, you're right, the one that really kind of killed everyone is that the way the rotation had been put together in the CCG is that, you know, we talked about the fact that there were blocks. So every year there was a base set and two expansions and then premium starters and associated promos. And that was considered one block. And the way that rotation worked is that the standard format was the most recent two blocks. So as soon as the base set in year three was introduced, all of the cards from the year one block were rotated out. And the card pool built up again as the expansions and promos and so forth for year three were released, which made it kind of interesting. There was a growing card pool to the whole thing. But anyway, you bought cards kind of feeling that they had a two-year standard life cycle. People expected that when the core set came out with the LCG, that was essentially going to take the place of the new base set, and that an organized play program was going to include the most recent base set, the Five Kings base set, which, as I said before, was a very well received and a really fun base set to play. But what FFG did is that they said, okay, we're drawing a line in the sand, and anything that was not released in the LCG format is not going to be part of standard play. So a lot of people were upset by the fact that their Five Kings cards only had a 1-year life cycle instead of a 2-year. And they were also very upset at the loss of a lot of the really interesting mechanics from it. Kind of interesting side note is that Five Kings was the first place that ever had a character agenda. There's one for each house, and you know that's another thing that eventually came back, and look at how well received that has been.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kind of things that you lost. And then the other thing is that because the base set only had the four houses, Martell and Greyjoy, poof, they were effectively gone from the competitive play environment. And as a result of that, you essentially lose a third of the playable houses. And Martell has always been one of the most popular ones, and Greyjoy, at the time, not as strong, but a very diehard loyalist to a lot of these houses. And it really it sat badly, not only that people couldn't play these houses that they really liked, but in the chapter packs, they were still publishing Martell and Greyjoy cards, which kind of killed a lot of those cards that were coming out until the expansions came. So,
Let's be honest about something. The core set, as it stands, is not the best place to start the game. Like, it doesn't have a ton of cool effects. It's probably like it could be a lot better. So I could just imagine these players that just had this super cool new base set that you're talking about, and all of a sudden they're stuck with just this core, which is probably a little lackluster, not super well put together, in my opinion.
Borders.
The borders changed.
That must have
been a letdown. I mean,
well, people, you know, the whole white border thing, you know, we could get into that. We don't have to, but actually the white border thing was a lot bigger in Call of Cthulhu than it was in Game of Thrones, because that dark background really added to the ambiance of the whole Lovecraft thing. You know, with Martin, it doesn't, black or white, you're still going to die. So,
should all just have been gray, really.
Yeah, really. But you're absolutely right, John. The quality of the cards was an additional letdown, because not only had you just come off of this great base set that people really enjoyed, but you kind of went to this whole Model T aspect of a lot of these cards. And keep in mind also that you're talking about a community that was really concentrated on Joust, looking at all these cards that were really kind of, you know, dumbed down for new players in a lot of their opinions, and really stuck to that whole melee multiplayer facet. And so a lot of people are looking at these cards and thinking, I know how much better this game can be, because 3 weeks ago I had cards that told me how much better this game can be. And so the loss of all of these cards, it really hurt people in that whole, this game could be so much more than it is. And so that whole loss of card pool, that whole depth of card pool that was gone, really took people by surprise. And you know, you have to go back to the tone of that letter, and you have to go back to the abrupt changes that, as a player base, a lot of these abrupt changes that really felt like they were dumbing down and making the game less than it was for a lot of these players, it felt like FFG didn't care about them anymore. It felt like, okay, well, hey, thanks for supporting the CCG and proving to us how great this game can be. We're changing the format, and we're going after these casual board game kind of players, and you guys, we'll pretend, but we don't really care about you as much. That's what it felt like to a lot of these people. And the competitive players, the people that really kind of kept the community alive for a lot of it, they started leaving in droves. A lot of them came back. as the card pool grew, and as the depth of the card pool has grown, and a lot of the new mechanics have come in, and the game, you know, mechanic wise and card wise and option wise, the game is at one of the best places it's ever been, CCG included. And that brought a lot of the players back as the card pool grew. A lot of them haven't come back, but they tend to be the more diehard CCG people, that the collectability was one of the things that really drove them. And they also tend to be the ones that have the hardest time letting go of just how disrespected and dismissed they felt.
I mean, we can sort of generalize about other players, but how did you handle that specifically? As a Greyjoy player and someone who then just lost his house and, you know?
Well, you know, it was, I didn't worry about it so much. What our local group did to kind of get us through that is we kind of agreed that it wasn't going to be worth dealing with an organized play program for a while because, well, one, it didn't really exist, and two, it wasn't really the environment that we wanted to play in. So what we did locally, a lot of the players that have been locally and a lot of the people that I played with in the Chicago area, what we did is we essentially pretended that the rotation rule never happened. Or so we kept playing Five Kings along with the core set and with the Clash of Arms, and then eventually the Time for Ravens, which was, by the way, the beginnings of the second expansion set for the Five Kings. So it's the Clash of Kings and the Time for Ravens chapter packs are the ones that play the best with the CCG cards, and the reason why is because they were first conceived of as CCG cards. So, you know, we kept playing with the Five Kings cards for another year or two, and, you know, that kind of helped get us through that while we waited for things to grow again.
Now, was there any anger around the way that they distributed their cards in the packs? The fact that, you know, some cards came as three of, while others were just one of? Because that drove me crazy when I first started playing.
It was exasperation more than anything else. You have to remember that for a CCG player who had just come out of, I effectively need to buy three booster boxes if I want to even have a set, let alone a play set, in terms of getting all the different rares that they needed. So that particular thing wasn't as jarring, I think, for CCG players, because they were used to buying, at, you know, buying three of these things was still kind of a bargain for us. What was really frustrating, though, is that I don't need nine of these other cards. I really don't. And, you know, particularly looking at some of the Clash of Kings chapter packs, some of those ones that were one of were just awesome, and some of those ones that were three of were coasters. And I don't need nine of them. And, you know, to essentially have nine of so many of these cards, it was frustrating more than anything else. So I can see where it would have been really annoying and maddening to someone that came into it feeling that there should have been no collectability at all. But for people that came out of the collectability environment, it was frustrating, but it was not as poorly received.
Well, I also came in when some of these packs weren't easy to find. So I could find one, and then I would only have one of that character, and it'd be like, but I really want to put two of him in my deck. And he's scrounging all over the internet to try to find.
I want reprinted. Another to be a Kraken, at least the second one. Just,
Well, why would you want another to be a Kraken when you couldn't play Greyjoy?
Oh, well, that's a very, very good point.
A good example is like Shadow Bob.
Yeah.
I couldn't get a hold of Shadow Bob for my life. I had one, and I'm like, he's really good. I'd love to. Yeah.
Well, and I think that was really frustrating because of the mass exodus from the CCG players into the LCG. It took the LCG a little bit of time to find its footing, and you have to remember that for the first year or two of the LCG, there were still a lot of Thrones CCG players kind of hanging around and still saying, oh, that talking about all the bad things that happened. And so I would not be surprised if the LCG model, which was totally unproven at that point, was a hard sell for, you know, the expansion packs. The core set's not a big deal. You can stock a core set the way you would stock a board game. But the expansion packs were a hard sell for a lot of the stores, because how do I know that people are going to buy these, particularly when you have a disgruntled ex-CCG player standing around talking about how disappointing the company is and how bad the game is now in comparison. So I can see why it would have been fairly difficult to find some of those chapter packs, just because I think that for the first three or four chapter pack cycles, it was hard to convince store owners to stock them.
It's still hard to convince store owners to stock them.
Well, yes, yeah. And that's certainly true. It's still hard to convince them to stock them, but at least now you have people that are clamoring for them and asking for them, and that helps people stock it more than saying, well, should I stock this? No, that game's dead. It's never going to go anywhere. The LCG killed it. And CCG players were saying that.
So one thing that they mentioned in that initial letter that never actually happened was they were going to be releasing a new core every Gen Con. this letter's a gem, and I highly recommend that our listeners have a look at it to see, you know, what exactly the LCG meant then and what it means now. But was there an announcement when they decided to change their policy on that, or was that with Deluxe Box?
Oh, no. There have never been any announcements of the changes in policy. The changes in policy just kind of happened, you know, in true FFG style. And I think that what happened is that a lot of people just kind of took the understanding that the expansion sets, which weren't actually released in time with Gen Con, but the expansion sets kind of took the place of a new core set. And I think that also a lot of people didn't really think about it because, quite honestly, no one wanted another core set. What they really want is for this one to be cleaned up and made better. But if they're going to turn out another core set like this, you know, one copy of 200 cards every year, no one really wanted that. And I think that everyone realized that after the first core set came out. and that's kind of it. Those were a lot of the mistakes I think that happened. Between the organized play program falling into limbo, which had really been a glue that held the community together, the major change and complete upheaval of limiting the card pool to just the LCG set, which wasn't a particularly strong card pool to begin with anyway, were just a lot of mistakes, and then never really updating the core set into something stronger and more robust, I think, was another one of the mistakes that made the transition from CCG to LCG difficult for a lot of players, and we lost a lot of players that have never come back, and some that stayed away for years.
Mm-hmm. So I should certainly hope that they've learned a lot, that whatever rotation plan they have won't completely leave a whole bunch of broken cards or people's favorite themes half hanging, you know, either give them a clean severance or, you know, not leave a season's mechanic without a way to change the seasons, that kind of thing.
Well, honestly, that's my biggest worry about a rotation scheme. I think that they have learned a lot, and I think that a rotation scheme is a very different thing from a reboot, which is essentially what the CCG to LCG was. So I really don't anticipate the same level of problem or the same level of confusion and disheartenment. I don't even know if that's a word, but it kind of fits with what's going on.
K-Tom said it was.
Yeah, there you go. K-Tom said disheartenment.
It's a rule, though.
Good to go. It's it's in the FAQ. It's penciled into the FAQ, but it's in the FAQ. But anyway, I think that you're not going to run into that same level of problems. That said, I actually have a lot of confidence in what Nate and Eric have been doing, thinking these things through recently. And the fact that they said we're going to do this and have given people kind of a year to know that we're coming up with a rotation scheme the fact that they didn't jump on it and just throw something out there as a quick fix, I think that that shows a lot of promise that they're going to do this well and that they're really thinking through some of the problems and that they've learned from mistakes that the company has made in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to close off with a completely unrelated question that I've always sort of wondered, and I think a lot of listeners have. You've almost become an official judge. You judge at some of the biggest events for FFG in Game of Thrones, including Worlds and Gen Con. How did that happen? How did you get elevated from community rules lawyer to the actual highest authority, practically?
It has more to do with the fact that I just never left, and I think that people got familiar with me. part of it is that I never
really
felt...
You're an actual lawyer.
Well, no, I actually wasn't when I started all this. I went to law school. I went to law school between starting Thrones and now, but that's one of the reasons why I was kind of absent from Thrones for about a year or two there. But let's see. The first tournaments that I judged were back in 2004, and it really just kind of came down to some of the folks at FFG put a call out to the Night's Watch people saying, hey, is anyone going to be at Origins that could run the tournaments for us because our volunteers that were going to be able to do it, turns out that they can't make it. So I volunteered for that.
Good Lord, the Origins days. Reading out of news out of Origins, convinced I would go. Those dreams have died. There's not much of Origins.
Yeah, well, Origins used to be a lot bigger, I think. Well, at least a lot bigger for FFG than they seem to be now. And I think it used to be more of a playing event or a playing con than it is now as well. But I don't really know. Anyway, so they put out a call for, hey, we really need someone. Can someone help? And I wasn't doing anything that weekend. It says, hey, free GameCon. What the heck? So I went and I ran the events and got to know the guys, did well, was efficient with it, was able to keep things going, was able to answer rules questions clearly and concisely and make people kind of understand where I was coming from with that. And so that's how I kind of met everyone and why they kept asking me, hey, if you want to volunteer for this, will you? And so I was able – they kept asking me back just because I was willing to do it.
So do you still get invited down to Gen Con and Worlds, or do they help you financially to get you down there? Or is that if you happen to be there, you get the honor of TLA?
They what they'll usually do is that if I'm volunteering for them, they'll buy my badge and get me into it that way. They offer to put me up in the rooms that they have, but those rooms for their volunteers and for the staff tend to be like 4 to 6 people crammed into a room, so I'll spring for my own room kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they still ask me if I can, or they still ask me if I will. So I wasn't able to get to Gen Con this year, but I will be at Worlds. So I will be running the tournaments at Worlds.
John and I are both in world's limbo right now. John, if harvest ends at the right time, his mother-in-law can come help take care of the kids so he can get away. And I've sort of attempting to clear my own guilt about leaving the newborn with my wife. I asked her, and she said, fine, you can go. And I'm like, but I'm gone the entire week before in the U.K., and gone 2 weeks later somewhere else for work-related stuff. So I'm trying to find a way to salve my guilt.
Right.
All right. Well, I think it mostly covers the transition. I don't know if there's anything else that you specifically want to add.
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Been juggling two schedules, trying to find the right time to bring in the big guns like yourself.
Well, and the right topic as well. No one really wants to hear me talk about Aaron Hall.
You'd
be surprised.
That our last episode on rules was really, really popular, where I brought in that Ygritte scenario that we had discussed.
Oh.
And some other ones as well.
Well, here you go. Here's an idea for another one. You can bring me back, and you can have a Stump K-Tom show and have people write in rules questions that they think that I'll never be able to answer. And then between Alex and I, we'll see if we can get an answer on the fly.
I love it.
All right. Well, then we'll have to make sure that the questions are sent to John specifically so I don't get to see them beforehand. But I do like this idea. So we're going to do exactly that. We're going to get any listeners that want to send in questions over the next couple of weeks to email us at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure the subject is Stump K-Tom, so Alex won't have a look at any of those emails. And try not to make the scenarios too long to explain. So, you know, you can definitely go over any rules interactions, and if it takes more cards, that's fine. But if you're just trying to stump us by throwing 40 cards that we have to read out on air, I don't think that'll be great for our listeners. Anyway, send those directly to our email and expect to see them in the Stump K-Tom segment whenever that shows up. All right, closing segments. We have very little. We actually just have one very big tournament coming up this week, and that's the Tournoi de la Main, Tourney of the Hand, which is the French version of the Road to Stalag. That's happening this weekend.
I guess with that, we'll have our snappy sign-off. Are you ready for it, Alex?
Well, there is one more thing. I actually had Rekob asked me to mention Varberg Morgulis again, because that's coming up the week after that. And they've been spoiling artwork for some of the prizes they're giving out. And all of that is showing up on CardGameDB in the thread for Varberg Morgulis. So if you were on the fence, check out the art and tell yourself that you definitely want to win them. They look pretty cute. I quite like the break-in style.
Excellent. So now we're ready for a snappy sign-off?
I'm never ready for a snappy sign-off.
Okay, here we go.
Something you like, anything.
I don't know what to do.
No. You got shyness hit, so she decided not to do her snappy sign-off.
Aww.
It's too bad. She had a good one. So listeners will have to hold for another week to hear the snappy sign-off from my daughter.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.